From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, one woman's story of surviving anti-gay violence. Claudia Brenner and her lover were hiking on the Appalachian Trail when they were attacked. Brenner was shot 5 times. Her lover was shot to death. Brenner has written a memoir called 8 Bullets. Also today, Tony Mazzocchi on his efforts to create a new political party for workers. He's a former vice president of the Oil, Chemical, and Atomic Workers International Union. Jerry Lee Lewis has a new CD. Ken Tucker will have a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The Senate has called on President Clinton to unilaterally lift the arms embargo on the Bosnian government. The vote was 69-29 and would affect arms shipments to the Bosnian government. The Clinton administration has fought the vote, but the Senate pressed ahead with the vote, which could end the United Nations mission in Bosnia. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
In a serious challenge to President Clinton's foreign policy skills, the Senate has voted to unilaterally lift the arms embargo. After a series of passionate speeches, the Senate approved the amendment. Opponents argued that the action would intensify the fighting in Bosnia, lead to a withdrawal of the peacekeepers, undermine the NATO alliance, and erode support for other embargoes. But supporters, led by Majority Leader Bob Dole, argued the ban is immoral and the legislation would send that message.
Message to the world, not just to Bosnia, that if you're an independent nation, if you're a member of the United Nations, that you have a right to self-defense.
While the measure was approved by a veto-proof margin, some who voted for it say they would not vote to override the president on foreign policy. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
UN Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali has given up his authority over NATO airstrikes in Gurajda. UN military commanders in the region will have the last word. The NATO allies had criticized Boutros-Ghali for being too reluctant to call in airstrikes. NATO has said it will launch preemptive and prolonged airstrikes on the Bosnian Serbs if they advance on the UN safe haven of Gorazda. Italians have taken to the streets in a show of support for the people of Bosnia. Regina Sansaloni has more from Rome.
More than 200 demonstrations are taking place across Italy, including a national march in the capital in an expression of solidarity for the victims of the war taking place at the country's doorstep. Union leaders, peace groups, and political party heads who organized the event chose Rome as the principal site, as it symbolizes the crossroads of diverse cultures, religions, and traditions, and as such, needs to be in the front line of the stand against ethnic violence. Meanwhile, Foreign Minister Susan Agnelli is in the Croatian port town of Split, to emphasize an intensification of humanitarian aid for refugees. Currently, 4 weekly flights filled with medicine and basic necessities depart Pisa and arrive in Split. For National Public Radio, this is Regina Sansaloni in Rome.
Former Michigan Governor George Romney is dead. He was 88. He made a short run for a Republican presidential nomination in 1968. He was also a former American Motors Corporation chairman. Romney was the dean of Republican politics in Michigan. President Nixon named him Secretary of Housing and Urban Development. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 8.5 points at 4,706 in heavy trading. The Nasdaq is up 6.5 points at 1,000. This is NPR. 2 people who were critically injured in yesterday's bombing in a subway in Paris died today, bringing the death toll to 7, Lynn Terry reports.
Interior Minister Jean-Louis Debray tightened security throughout the country, calling up an extra 1,800 police. They've been making random identity checks and roaming the subway, train stations, and public places. Debray called on the public to watch out for any suspicious parcels or people. There was a spate of false bomb alerts throughout the country, and stores and subway stations were evacuated. Some subway stations in Paris were relatively deserted today, as people took buses instead. Meanwhile, investigators are still combing through the wreckage. They still don't have any firm leads. The government has received several phone calls claiming responsibility for the attack, but it's taking none seriously. Debray said the bombing could be linked to Algerian radicals or the Bosnian Serbs. For National Public Radio, I'm Lynn Terry in Paris.
Israel's Land for Peace deal with Syria has narrowly survived a parliamentary vote. Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin's coalition government has defeated a bill that could have blocked concessions on the Golan Heights. Foreign Minister Shimon Peres had warned if the bill passed, it would kill chances for peace with Syria. Rabin's government has expressed willingness to return the Golan Heights, which it captured from Syria during the 1967 war. A published report says NASA has found heat damage on an O-ring seal on a booster rocket used in the recent launch of the Discovery space shuttle. The Houston Chronicle reports the same problem was found on the previous mission of the Atlantis, which had docked with the Russian Mir space station. NASA's shuttle manager had described the Atlantis problem as an abnormality, but a member of NASA's Aerospace Safety Advisory Panel says the latest finding could mean something more serious. The next shuttle mission is set for August 5th. Endeavour is scheduled to start an 11-day science mission. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Claudia Brenner, is a victim of anti-gay violence. It's a terrifying story. Back in the summer of 1988, she was hiking with her lover, Rebecca White, on the Appalachian Trail. They thought they were alone, but a man who they'd run into at their campsite had followed them. He spied on them as they made love, then shot them, wounding Claudia and killing Rebecca. Claudia Brenner tells the story in her new book, Eight Bullets. She's an architect who also does a lot of public speaking about anti-gay violence. The man who shot her and killed her lover, Stephen Roy Carr, is now serving a life sentence in a Pennsylvania maximum security prison. I asked Claudia Brenner about her first encounter with Carr at the campsite.
Actually, the first encounter with the man who shot us was between he and Rebecca. Rebecca went up to use an outhouse on a campsite and also check a logbook, and she encountered this individual who she didn't expect to see, and he asked her for cigarettes. They had a brief exchange, and then she came back to me. I actually didn't see him or speak with him at that first encounter, but she told me that someone else was at the campsite with us. Up till that point, we had believed that we were completely alone, and so that was the first encounter.
And that was particularly awkward, too, because believing that you were alone, she was naked.
Right. We were only partially dressed, so that was extremely uncomfortable for her. And she believed it was also uncomfortable for the individual that she met. So we, of course, immediately put our clothes on and then had nothing really more to say or do with him.
And what was the second encounter?
I actually saw Stephen Roy Carr as we left the campsite. We packed up all our things a while later and left the campsite, and I actually saw him in a lean-to, and I believe, you know, I waved, said, see ya, when we passed by. So you might call that an encounter, but that was the first time I actually saw him. But a little later on, probably about an hour later, when we were hiking on the trail, we were checking our directions and looking at a map, and about 30 yards from us, I heard a voice saying, "Are you lost?" And, of course, we weren't lost, and it was Stephen Roy Carr again. We went in one direction, and he continued on the trail in another direction, and I never really expected to see him again.
But he was carrying a gun, a rifle, wasn't he?
Yeah, that time when we met him on the trail, when we saw him on the trail, he had a rifle slung over his shoulders, and he had both of his arms draped over the ends of the rifle. And one of the things that struck me about that, or as I think about it in you know, the years since the shooting, is that he was extremely comfortable with that weapon. I think I make reference to how I've seen soldiers in countries which have soldiers on the streets a lot. I'm thinking about my experiences in Israel, how they have men carry weapons almost as an extension of their body, very, very, very comfortably. So when he was holding the rifle, it concerned me, but he was not threatening me with the rifle in any sense of the word, and so I believed that he was just continuing on his way and maybe going to shoot at some small game or something.
Right before you had shot, you had decided to make camp for the night. You were on the Appalachian Trail. You set up camp, and I believe you were making love, and then there was an explosion, or what felt like an explosion. What are your memories of what happened?
My memory was that the setting was really idyllic and that I was completely enjoying myself in the warm early spring with a woman who I loved a lot, beside a stream with gurgling water and a blue sky. and that all of a sudden it felt like the world exploded. And I had no idea what had happened. I really thought about a volcano or an earthquake. But I saw blood everywhere, and I knew somehow that they wouldn't make you bleed, a volcano or an earthquake wouldn't make you bleed. And Rebecca somehow put together that there had been a gunshot. And, of course, my arm had been hit, and I was aware that, you know, it felt like my arm had exploded. And as soon as she said to me, "Where did you get shot?" it all, I understood exactly what had happened.
There were eight bullets.
Yes.
That Stephen Ricard fired. What was the fate of each of those bullets?
The first bullet hit me in my arm, as I described, and blood went everywhere. Very, very quickly, there were two more bullets. They hit me on both sides of my neck, kind of grazing my chin and my neck on both sides. At that point, I don't even remember the particulars, except I just started to scream, and the bullets were coming really quickly. I got hit in the face. I believe that was the fourth bullet, a bullet which actually shattered some of my teeth. And then the fifth bullet, there was something about the way that I was sitting which made me in Stephen Roy Carr's range and not Rebecca. So by the fifth bullet, Rebecca had told me to get down close to the ground, and I did. And the fifth bullet hit me at the top of my head. It kind of grazed the back of my head. So I guess she realized that he could hit me even that low, and she told me to run. So I immediately ran to a big tree on the campsite, and as soon as I moved, Stephen Roy Carr must have had access to Rebecca, you know, because I had moved. And, of course, she started to run, too, and he was able to hit her twice, once in the back of the head. That was the sixth bullet. And then in the real meaty part of her back, that was the seventh bullet. The eighth bullet missed us both, and we both wound up behind a tree.
You didn't even realize at first what was happening, you know, that you'd been shot. When you realized that somebody was shooting at you, did you figure it was the man who you'd seen with the rifle earlier?
I was certain that it was the man we had seen with the rifle, who, of course, had no name in my mind then, because he was the only person that Rebecca and I had seen the whole time we had been out, which was only just about a day, but he was the only person that we had seen on the trail at all, and he had had a gun.
Was your mind working when you were shot and you had to figure out, now what do I do?
At first, I would say that I was utterly and completely panicked. And when I was screaming, I was somewhat paralyzed. Rebecca told me what to do. She told me to get down first. Then she told me to run behind a tree. I'm fairly sure that I would have died if she hadn't been there, that she really saved my life somehow. Somehow her brain was still functioning in the emergency. When we got behind the tree, she continued to function. In fact, she was the one who told me to stop the bleeding. I was bleeding a lot externally. And she was bleeding, but I didn't know. Of course, she was bleeding internally. But in any case, at some point after I started to stop my own bleeding and I realized how badly Rebecca was actually hurt, my brain started to click in, and I really started to function well. But up to that point, I had been completely paralyzed with fear and was not thinking that clearly.
You knew that you needed to get help, but Rebecca couldn't walk. She was hurt too bad. But must have been a really difficult decision to leave her behind and to go look for help.
Probably that was, as scary as the whole shooting was, probably that was the worst moment for me, was the realization that we weren't both getting out of there and the realization that I had to leave her and get help by myself. That was it was already as awful as you could possibly imagine, and I knew it was just dreadfully, horribly awful, but when I had to go by myself and I had to leave Rebecca, it became even more awful.
It amazed me reading your memoir, Eight Bullets, that you remembered to take certain things with you. What did you take?
It was sort of incredible that once my brain started functioning, I really began to think, and I began to think as one would think in an emergency. So I remembered that I needed a map to get out of there because we had been hiking with a map. So I went to look for the map, and at first I couldn't find it. I ran back to Rebecca. Then I went back, and I found the map. Then I thought maybe I would need a flashlight because I knew it was toward the end of the day already, and I thought it would get dark, and what if it got dark and I needed a flashlight? So I went to our packs and I looked for a flashlight, and I finally found a flashlight. And then finally I thought that I realized I was cold. My shirt was soaked with blood, and I put on a sweatshirt, and that was the last thing that I did was I got a sweatshirt for me, and then I got a sleeping bag and covered up Rebecca, who I figured was probably cold also.
Now, what did you think the odds were that the guy who shot you was going to be hiding behind a tree ready to knock you off when you went looking for help?
I didn't know. I thought the entire walk that it was entirely possible that he would be there at any moment and that he would blow me away. And I guess I figured that would be better than just dying in the woods for me. I didn't think I was going to die at that point. Something started to happen in my body as a result of either stopping the bleeding and what I now know is I actually stabilized my body in some kind of shock place. But I was okay. I mean, I was okay to walk and I was okay to move forward. I had a very, very hard time swallowing. And I had a very hard time turning my neck, but I was able to walk.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Claudia Brenner, and she's written a memoir called 8 Bullets about how she was shot 5 times and how her lover Rebecca was shot to death in 1988 on the Appalachian Trail. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Claudia Brenner, her memoir, 8 Bullets, is about how she was shot and how her lover, Rebecca, was shot to death in 1988 on the Appalachian Trail. When you knew you had to get out of the woods and look for help, you really, it seems to me you were really smart. I mean, you had your map, you found the trail that led to the road, you realized you should stay on the road, you even thought that the guy who shot you probably wouldn't be on the road because he'd probably be out hiding someplace if he had any brains. But it took hours before a car stopped for you.
It took hours, and I just walked. I remember I was thinking in my head just very few thoughts over and over again. One of the thoughts I was thinking about was just walk. Don't run. Don't try and run. Just walk. Just keep walking. And when I would get tired, I would just keep on walking. And I thought about what I would say when I finally saw somebody. What would I say to them? And I composed several sentences in my mind, which I actually said to the car that eventually stopped for me.
What were the sentences?
In my mind, I decided I would say, "You must help me. I've been shot." And that's exactly what I said, actually, when a car stopped.
How many cars passed you by?
Only one car passed me by, and I was just completely flabbergasted. I didn't know what to think. I thought I was waving it down, and they just kept on going.
So tell us about the people who stopped for you. So
finally, I got to an intersection of a large road. The car that passed me by actually passed me by on a state forest road. But I finally got to the intersection of what you might think of as a two-lane highway. And I stepped out into the road. It was dark by then, and I had my flashlight, and I was determined that no other car would pass me by. I made huge circles of light with my flashlight, and a car pulled up, and it had two young men in it, 17 and 16, local kids. It was an older, kind of big American car, and as soon as I saw that it wasn't the guy with the gun, I was entirely relieved, and then I said to them, "You must help me, I've been shot." And they put me in the car right away and took me in the direction of emergency help. It was still about a 20-minute ride till we got to a small town that had a fire and police station.
And you told them the facts that they needed to know in case you lost consciousness.
Yeah, I just told them over and over what my name was and that Rebecca White was on the trail and where she was, as much information as I could give them about where we had been and that she had been shot.
So the guys who picked you up, they took you to the police station, then you went to the hospital, and then you were actually helicoptered to a trauma center.
Right. I was at each step of the process, it became clearer to me that, you know, I was really badly injured, and at some point I had to relinquish the idea that I was going to go back and look for Rebecca, you know, show the police where Rebecca was. They immediately started a search for Rebecca in the first town where I was taken and, you know, had organized a search for her.
When did you find out that she was dead?
I actually didn't find out that Rebecca was dead until the next morning. The state police found her about midnight, and when I was in the trauma unit at Hershey Medical Center, I actually asked a nurse there not to tell me if she was dead. I said that I just didn't want to hear from strangers. And he relayed that information to the state police, and in fact, they withheld that information from me. And the next morning, my closest friends were with me, and one of them told me.
You were told that Rebecca would have died even if she was shot on an operating table because the wound, one of the shots in particular, hit her so badly there was no way she was going to live.
Yeah, I was told that, and her liver exploded. That's how she died. And that actually helped me because that walk took me a long time, and I think it would have been torture to think that had I gone more quickly, somehow had I gotten help more quickly, she might have lived. In some ways, the simpleness of that statement, which was told to me by medical people, made somehow that the timing of it all easier to bear.
Claudia Brenner is my guest. Her new memoir is called 8 Bullets. When the police asked you what had happened, you didn't reveal to them that you and Rebecca were lovers. Why did you decide that you should keep that a secret?
That part of the my non-disclosure, I didn't disclose to the police that Rebecca and I were lovers for about 2 days. Although I, of course, told my friends and my family immediately that he saw us, which was a very powerful statement, which was understood immediately, that someone saw us, realized that we were lesbians, and shot us because we were lesbians. I think that my self-protection as a lesbian clicked in somewhere in that emergency, and I felt so unsafe and so traumatized that without making a conscious decision that first night, I withheld my relationship from the police. I just told them the facts. And, of course, several days later, I told them everything, and that turned out to not even be a stumbling place in terms of the Pennsylvania State Police.
So what was the reaction of the investigators when you told them that you were gay?
The state police very quickly realized, I think, that Rebecca and I were lovers. So I don't think that that was any surprise to them. I think that they were relieved to hear everything from me that I could possibly share, because I think that then they knew that they had all the possible information that they could use to, capture the murderer and proceed with the case. And I think that by then, there had been quite a lot of questioning of myself, my chosen family, my friends who were present, my parents who were also present at the hospital. And I think that the state police had a certain amount of respect for the feat that I had undertaken getting myself out of the woods. They saw where we were. They saw the state of affairs there. And I think that they began to believe me. I think they had believed me from the beginning, but I think that when they had all the information, they completely believed me and had a lot of information to go on in terms of their investigation. Much later, a few days later, they were able to bring in an FBI artist, and I was able to create a composite, which was very helpful in the capture of Stephen Roy Carr.
Claudia Brenner is my guest. Her new memoir, 8 Bullets, is about how she was shot 5 times and her lover, Rebecca, was shot to death in 1988 on the Appalachian Trail. Did the defense try to use against you the fact that you were lesbians?
The defense tried very hard to use the issue of lesbianism to inflame the case. One of the things that the defense wanted to suggest was that somehow Rebecca and I making love together provoked their client into a rage of some sort where his actions became uncontrollable. And of course, provocation in the eyes of the court has nothing to do with the circumstances of Stephen Roy Carr's shooting. He was hidden 85 feet away in the woods. He had deliberately and intentionally stalked us and followed us and hid and spied on us, and then he opened fire, continuing to shoot us even after we were screaming. Nothing about strangers who have no connection and someone hiding and shooting has anything to do with provocation, but it was an effort on the part of the defense to inflame the case and cause attention to be focused on lesbianism as opposed to being focused on murder. I might say it was fully unsuccessful in the eyes of the court, and it was not permissible as a defense, but there was still that effort on the part of the defense.
What was the outcome of the case?
The outcome of the case was that Stephen Ricard was convicted of first-degree murder. He was sentenced to life with no parole in maximum security prison in Pennsylvania.
So do you feel safe from Stephen Ricard knowing that he's serving life without parole?
Yeah, I certainly don't feel threatened by Stephen Ricard in particular. No, you know, I feel like he is within the system, and that he's a person whose resources are very, very limited, and I don't anticipate that he'll have any success on any appeal that he might decide to proceed with, or any success with requesting clemency from the governor.
Having been the victim once now of anti-gay violence, are you worried in a way that you'd never been before about it happening again?
I really didn't know very much about anti-gay violence when Rebecca and I got shot. I think I thought, like many, many people, think that anti-gay violence was a matter of harassment. It was something that happened, I thought, you may think the same thing, that it happened late at night outside of bars to men, maybe in a bad part of town, certainly with some alcohol involved. And in fact, it does happen in those circumstances. But I had no idea that it could happen and be a matter of life and death. And I had no idea that it could happen, in a rural situation, in an urban situation, to women, to men, to college graduates, to, people that were, you might say, playing by the rules. So am I frightened of it? Particularly now, I'm probably more aware that it can happen now than I was before, but I don't think that I'm more frightened.
Now, I understand you and your friends won't go camping anymore.
Well, you know, some of the joy of being out in the woods, some of the joy and of that peace for me has been permanently taken, or as far as I can tell, it's been 7 years now, and it's not appealing to me to be out in the woods, and I'm sad about that. But I don't consider that a gigantic loss in my life. So, yeah, I'm not that comfortable. I no longer can just breathe deep and enjoy the solitude of the woods and the silence of the woods. It's something that I don't know that I'll have access to again.
Well, Claudia, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Claudia Brenner's new memoir, 8 Bullets, is published by Firebrand Books. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Tony Mazzocchi's campaign to create a third party, a labor party. He says labor's interests are no longer represented by Democrats or Republicans. Mazzocchi is former vice president of the Oil, Chemical, and Atomic Workers International Union. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Jerry Lee Lewis's new CD.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The United Nations says the evacuation of Jepa isn't the same as what happened in Srebrenica. When Srebrenica fell to the Bosnian Serbs, there were widespread reports of atrocities. The UN is now keeping track of the people it's evacuating from Jepa to make sure no one is dragged off the buses. Refugees are being sent to the central Bosnian town of Zenica, but the UN and other relief officials say they're worried that fighting-age Muslim men from Jepa continue to hide in the hills around the conquered town. Federal agents who were at the Waco standoff with the Branch Davidians are contradicting yesterday's testimony given to lawmakers investigating the incident. Agent Jim Cavanaugh of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms gave emotional testimony today. He disputed reports that federal agents fired first on the Davidians, saying he saw fellow agents shot at first.
I sat there and I watched it. And the gunfire came through those double white doors. I watched it. It pushed the doors against their jams out toward the agents. And in fact, two agents were shot there. Jerry Petrilli was shot in the chest and his vest and knocked down. I think the other witness, Ballesteros, was also here and he was shot in the finger. It's unbelievable, but that's what happened. And anybody else who says anything different, they shot first.
Retired FBI agent Jeffrey Jamar also told lawmakers Branch Davidian leader David Koresh constantly made promises that he never kept. Jamar rejected testimony that the government turned down a deal for Koresh to come out after finishing a biblical manuscript. He said there was never a deal struck with Koresh. Former Michigan Governor George Romney died at his home this morning in suburban Detroit. NPR's Don Gagne reports from Detroit.
George Romney was elected governor of Michigan three times, starting in 1962. A former auto executive, Romney was a moderate Republican who refused to endorse the 1964 presidential bid of conservative Barry Goldwater. In 1968, he ran for the Republican presidential nomination himself, but his candidacy was marked by his controversial statement to a television reporter that he had earlier supported the Vietnam War because he had been, quote, brainwashed by U.S. generals and diplomats. He eventually dropped out of the race and later took a job as President Nixon's Secretary of Housing and Urban Development. George Romney died at his home. A family member says he collapsed while working out on his treadmill. He was 88 years old. This is Don Gagne in Detroit.
South Korea's president says his nation is grateful for all the United States has done to protect it. President Kim Young-sam addressed a joint meeting of Congress today. Stock prices fell today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrials dropped more than 7 points to end the day at 4,707, breaking a two-day winning streak. Advances led declines. This is NPR. The makers of vitamins and other dietary supplements are urging Congress to change federal rules governing the use of food stamps. The companies want consumers who shop with food stamps to be allowed to buy their products just like they do fruits and vegetables. NPR's Greg Peppers reports.
The House Agriculture Subcommittee on Nutrition voted earlier this month to allow the use of food stamps to purchase vitamins. It did so as part of a larger bill that reauthorizes food stamps for the next 5 years. As the measure heads to the full committee, debate over the vitamin issue is heating up once again. A critic of the so-called vitamin bill, Dr. Larry Brown of Tufts University, says the legislation is a bid by the $4 billion-a-year dietary supplement industry to broaden its market and extend its wealth. But supporters like Representative Bill Emerson, a Missouri Republican, says it's an issue of expanding the diet choices of low-income Americans. Critics of the legislation in the fruit and vegetable industry contend that a balanced diet and not vitamin pills and mineral supplements is the key to sound nutrition and good health. The food stamp program helps more than 26 million low-income Americans buy groceries and pumps $23 billion a year into the food and farm economy. I'm Greg Peppers in Washington.
A House panel has endorsed the Base Closure Commission's recommendations. The House National Security Committee voted 43-10 against a resolution to reject the list. The Independent Base Closure Commission recommends closing 79 military bases and realigning 26 others. Hundreds of police are patrolling Paris subways as investigators try to find out who bombed a train yesterday. 7 people have died. More than 80 were hurt in the rush hour blast. 11 people are critically hurt. Authorities say it could be anyone who might be responsible: Algerian extremists, Bosnian Serbs angry over a reported French attack, or groups linked to the terrorist Carlos the Jackal. He was imprisoned by French authorities last year. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR, in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In American politics, the common wisdom is third parties always fail. But that's not stopping Tony Mazzocchi. He's calling for the creation of a Labor Party, and he's organized a group called Labor Party Advocates to form it. They plan to hold a convention next June to create the party. Mazzocchi is a lifelong labor activist. He's the former vice president of the Oil, Chemical, and Atomic Workers International Union and now serves as presidential assistant. Mazzocchi was working closely with Karen Silkwood at the time of her death. He was also one of the most forceful advocates of the Occupational Safety and Health Act, OSHA. Now he fears that labor will never again be the force it once was, unless it forms its own party. He says the labor movement has lost influence with the Democratic Party. The Democrats, he says, take labor's money and give little in return. I asked him if he thinks labor has lost power because the labor movement has shrunk. The AFL-CIO represented 35% of the workforce in 1955, but only represents 16% today.
Labor's lost influence because of its own embrace, and I'm talking about the bureaucracy of the labor movement, its embrace of the Democratic Party, rather than exploring an alternative to the Democratic Party. The Democrats take labor for granted because they tell them very candidly, you have no other place to go. And that's why a labor party is necessary in order to demonstrate there is someplace else to go. We're choosing an alternative path.
Of course, a lot of people within labor think that you're making a big mistake in trying to start a third party, because third parties never win in America. And also there's the criticism that not only would the Labor Party lose, but it would drain votes away from the Democrats and help ensure a Republican victory, which would be, many people in labor believe, would that a Republican victory would be worse than a Democratic victory.
Well, that's because some people have a very narrow definition of what the word politics means. And politics, as they see it, means voting in the electoral process. Our conception of a labor party does not hold that electing people is our fundamental task. Our fundamental task is creating a new agenda, reshaping the national debate, and to create a party that's ideologically driven. We reject the electoral route initially. We want to become a movement again. The only gains that people have made in this nation, working people, have been through movements, civil rights movement, the labor movement, the environmental movement. Legislation has only been a reaction to the existence of these movements. What this effort is all about is the recreation of a new movement and the rejuvenation of a culture that once existed, a working-class culture in this country. So part of this task in creating a party, a class party, we make no bones about it, this is going to be a party of the working class. We'll break down a nonsense that we're the middle class, we're the working class, and we have class interests. We want to, we've looked at the model of the right wing. They are ideologically driven. They aren't prone to compromise. They have dictated the political cadence in this country, and both parties have reacted to that particular cadence. We need to do the same thing.
You say you want a new agenda for labor. Give me some specifics of what should be on this new agenda.
We need to develop an agenda that addresses the future of work in this nation. This is the first generation of Americans who understand totally that their children will have it worse than they have had it. So the agenda will include, will be basically based on an economic pedestal. We have to readdress the economic injustice that exists in our society. Programs like a wage for every American, a wage or a job. the right to decent jobs at decent wages with decent conditions. These are rapidly disappearing. If you look at, we've lost over 4.5 million decent paying jobs over the, in just a 6-year period. So our work is cut out for us as far as an agenda.
You say you want a working class culture. I'm not sure what working class means anymore. There was a time when working class was understood to mean people who worked in factories, people who did manual labor. A lot of those factory jobs don't exist anymore. What does working class mean?
Well, that's an ill definition of working class. When I grew up, working class meant anyone who worked for a wage and wasn't a manager or a small business person. Whether you're a white-collar or a blue-collar person, it never was meant to just encompass blue-collar workers. An office clerical worker is a member of the working class. They work for someone. And that's a large group of people. In a culture that existed when I came into this workforce, you understood the value of organization, of unions. You supported unions. In those days, you had workers had the right to throw a picket line up in front of an establishment that might not have been on strike but was handling goods made by strikers. That was outlawed under Taft-Hartley. People would refuse to cross picket lines when that culture existed. If you lived in a neighborhood, it was a working-class neighborhood, and you scabbed on a strike, you probably could not come back to that neighborhood. Scabs had to be imported. People understood the nature of their class, and they knew the nature of those who were benefiting at their expense. That's been muddied over recent years due to a whole host of circumstances.
My guest is Tony Mazzocchi. He's trying to create a labor party. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Tony Mazzocchi is my guest, and he's a former vice president of the Oil, Chemical, and Atomic Workers Union. He's the founder of Labor Party Advocates, which is trying to create a new party, a labor party. I'm interested in how you first got involved in labor. Did your father work in a union or your mother?
Well, my father was a trade unionist, the Amalgamated Clothing Workers. He was an immigrant, came here in 1900, deeply involved in many labor struggles, was pro-Roosevelt to his core, and learned about labor unions around a dinner table during the Depression. I myself became active in the labor movement when I left the Army at the end of World War II and went to work in the automobile industry and then ultimately in the chemical industry. And
what kind of work were you doing in the chemical industry?
Oh, just ordinary work of mixing large groups of chemicals one to another, not knowing what they were, and mixing them under directions of someone else, and did various jobs. But I became a union official 2 or 3 years into work, and basically worked full-time for the union ever since then.
So when you started working with chemicals, I believe that was in the cosmetics industry?
Yes. Just bulk chemicals and making a product that looked harmless.
Did you have any idea what was in the chemicals?
No, not at all. Most of us didn't. Most of us always assumed that whatever was in these chemicals was safe to handle because we thought someone would not let us work with substances that were dangerous.
So when did you start thinking that the vats of chemicals you were working with might actually be harmful and you wanted to know more about them?
Well, I think basically that occurred in the very early 60s when in the 50s, I thought most of the problems were in the radioactive industries because we represented nuclear workers in my own union. But then when I became legislative director for my union in Washington, I began to hear complaints from workers all over the country about particular substances in their workplace. And I saw this as a trend, and what I thought were only isolated instances of problems, I began to see it as a collective trend, that no workplace was safe, and no one really knew what they work with, and no one actually measured the amount of toxics that were introduced into the workplace in any meaningful way. And there weren't any federal laws that addressed these problems, and the state laws were ridiculous to start with. So that began the agitation for a national law.
You were one of the key people behind the scenes who worked to pass OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Act, that was signed into effect by President Nixon in 1970. It set safety standards for workers and provided for plant inspections and for enforcement. What did you want out of that?
We wanted a workplace free of hazard, and the law provides that. Its fundamental tenet is the workplace shall be free of all hazard. And by the way, you've cited a clear example of why a movement is necessary rather than embracing the existing political parties. It was under Lyndon Johnson and the Democrats. We couldn't even get that law out of committee. We got it out of committee during the Nixon era and got it passed, not because Nixon was a friend of working people, but because people were in motion in movements, the environmental movement and reinvigorated labor movement who came to life around this issue.
You were one of the people who worked hardest getting Congress to pass OSHA. What, if anything, are you doing now that Congress is considering changing it?
Well, I think Congress, that fight is got to be approached differently. We've got to go back to doing what we did in the 60s by movement work back in the communities rather than lobbying here in this town. And this effort to create a new political party is part of that effort.
You know, there's so many different groups that have thought of a third party, but they've often thought of a third party that would unite a lot of different groups. You know, the Rainbow Coalition idea, for instance, where you take a lot of people who felt disenfranchised for one reason or another and you build a party around them or build a movement around them. You know, and you know, I think the National Organization for Women has considered this kind of thing, too. But why start a labor party as opposed to a party that would be have a broader definition?
Well, we think a labor party is the broadest definition. It's a class party. It incorporates all the people you're talking about. Look, the most integrated places in America are workplaces. Those are the most integrated places. Where do you find the most people of color? You find them working. You find them as members of unions. Some of the top leadership doesn't reflect that. But where the people are, that's where you see the average American are in workplaces. So we have our conceptualization is the broadest conceptualization, incorporating a hell of a lot of people. Now we have to define what our agenda is, and once it's defined, to work with others who support this particular movement. And we're not building it around an individual. We've looked at third party efforts in this country, and most of them collapsed after an election. The person that they were supporting did not receive an appropriate amount of votes, they disappeared the very next day. We're going beyond that. Someday we may run people for elective office, but they will have to grow out of a movement. The movement will have to define who they are and who they're responsible to, rather than creating some charismatic character who is supposed to lead us down this golden path. We reject that notion.
So if you're not going to run candidates, how do you hope to influence the electoral process?
Well, just look at what the right wing has done over the past 25 years by not running candidates. Who have emerged as candidates have grown out of that. They have a sharp ideological program. And by the way, they've influenced people in both parties to adopt their agenda. They've been persistent. They've been principled in around what they stand for, whether we agree with it or not. They have a take-no-prisoner strategy. They demand of their elected officials. You see that happening now. No compromise around the positions that we disagree with, but at least we understand they're ideological. They're driven. They've built a movement that's reshaped the political cadence in this country.
But now why do you need a party when you've got the AFL-CIO, whose job it is in part to try to influence the political process so that labor is represented.
There are a lot of people who don't consider themselves part of a labor organization. You've got to have a broader definition of what politics are. But a political movement that defines politics as an agenda that allows people to identify with it, it addresses every single problem that Americans confront in a way that's understandable to them. And it says, look, here's where we are, and there's those who benefit by our diminished standard of living. And you're going to have to be in a fight with those folks. And you need an instrument in which to fight with, a political party.
You have held office within the Oil, Chemical, and Atomic Workers Union, and you ran for president a couple of times, narrowly lost. Do you ever find yourself wishing that you had run for electoral office?
Well, I made that mistake one time in 1964. I had the nomination to run for Congress on Long Island, and I bowed out because the party felt that because of my position on nuclear weapons testing, I was opposed to it, thought I would hurt the party in Long Island, and I withdrew, and a substitute was introduced for me, Lester Wolf, actually, went on to be a congressperson. I'm glad I never chose that route. At one time, I thought I could do something there, but I realized that that would have been a comfortable, nonsensical life where I wouldn't have really been able to had an impact. I think I've been able to do more in the position I've been in.
Tony Mazzocchi, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Tony Mazzocchi is the founder of Labor Party Advocates. They plan to hold a convention next June to form a Labor Party. This is Fresh Air. The Senate has voted to lift the arms embargo against Bosnia. Linda Wertheimer is with us. Linda, what will you have on that on All Things Considered?
We'll have a story from Elizabeth Arnold, Terry, who's covering the Senate vote. Senator Dole got 69 votes for his proposition, which makes it veto-proof. So we'll see what the administration wants to do now and get a reaction from the UN. Also from California, the court is considering Prop 187 that restricts services to illegal aliens. Nigeria, we'll be talking about Nigeria with Randall Robinson of TransAfrica. Susan Stamberg talked to a bridge tender in Oregon. And we have a poet from Arkansas who wrote a poem about butter, barbecue sauce, and marriage.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. At the age of 59, Jerry Lee Lewis is one of the very few members of the first generation of rock and rollers who still has an active recording career. His new album, Young Blood, features Lewis performing songs written by people ranging from Hank Williams to Bobby Darin. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
Now you're looking at a man who's getting kind of mad. I had a lot of living, but it's all been bad. No matter how I struggle and strive.
Jerry Lee Lewis kicks off his new album with a cover of Hank Williams' I'll Never Get Out of This World Alive. It's a terrific version full of swagger, rancor, and desperation. Over the years, Lewis has covered lots and lots of Hank Williams songs. Lewis may be a founding father of 50s rock and roll, but he's always had a strong affinity with the founding father of 50s country music. What Jerry Lee shares with Hank is a sense of glorious fatalism, a feeling that life conspires against the happiness of the singer, but he's compelled to go on, to revel in his own misery. There's also a shock in this music. Who knew Jerry Lee Lewis had this much life left in him?
Like a rag, but my body in a strange position. You came, it's where you came.
That song, Goosebumps, sounds like some obscure 50s relic dug up for the occasion, but it's actually a new song co-written by Al Anderson, who used to be in NRBQ, and Andy Paley, who has produced this remarkable comeback album. Andy Paley is one of those guys who deserves more of a legend than he has. When I lived in Los Angeles in the late 70s, he was half of the Paley Brothers, a very fine pop-rock duo that made a few records that no one noticed. Paley's like Brian Wilson with Common Sense, a man with a knack for producing crystal-clear rock records that revitalize clichés. Working with Jerry Lee Lewis, Paley has done what no producer's done for Lewis in more than a decade. Recognize that you can't make Jerry Lee rock without letting him make hardcore country music.
Stayed out late, I bought round after round. Just for you, I played the fool. Yes, I was quite the clown. Words were spoken, hearts were broken, but now I hope you see it was the whiskey talking, not me. I didn't mean.
Throughout Youngblood, Lewis steadfastly refuses to turn into a nostalgia act. Listening to him, you're constantly confronted with the idea that the strongest creations of pop culture transcend their time. Youngblood could have been recorded in 1958. We should be very grateful it was cut in a fine fury in 1995.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Alan Tu, and Amy Sallet, with Nancy Updike and Sue Weinstein. Research assistance from Becky Cohn. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.